Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how to convince water drinkers that it's okay to drink recycled wastewater. And a TV star's next role, a real-life troubadour. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
I'm in awe of all of you. The fight I saw in you to get this done and make sure that your families continue to be cared for reminds me of why I entered public service in the first place.
The law says they must certify regardless of what they think or even know definitively. I have no idea why this stupid law is in place. If you're going to make them do it no matter what, why not just skip the certification? Because it clearly means nothing.
We're also committed to protecting school choice. The education freedom landscape in Arizona is something that I think parents pride and that Arizona should maintain.
Conservative businesswoman Karen Taylor Robeson is running for governor, and she has President Trump's complete and total endorsement.
Chaos, total chaos. And the one question we have to ask ourselves, are families in Arizona and across the country better off today than they were 100 days ago? I think the answer is unequivocal, no.
If there are issues that would arise with a voting machine, it's easier to discover them if the machine hardware and software are created in Birmingham or Buffalo or Boise, not in Beijing.
And joining me to talk about the resignations of two state agency directors, next year's gubernatorial campaign hitting the airwaves, and more, our former state school superintendent Jaime Molera of the firm Molera Alvarez. Jaime, good morning.
Good morning.
And Mike Hayner of Lumen Strategies. Mike, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Mike, let's start with the resignations of two of the agency directors that Governor Hobbs had appointed, not confirmed, the Access Director and the Director of the Department of Health Services. Basically, their resignations were kind of an acknowledgement that they weren't going to be able to get through the state Senate, the so-called Dino Committee. What do you make of the fact, and these are not the first, that have had this?
Well, what I make of that fact is that, again, an indicted fake elector is making these hearings hyper-partisan, and it's creating chaos in the system. And what the governor is trying to do is, again, bring continuity and sanity to these agencies so that they can run efficiently and effectively to the best degree that they can. And this partisan outburst by the senator is causing problems throughout the business community, the healthcare community, all of these agencies that impact everyday Arizonans.
Jaime, the Hobbs administration has referred to this committee over the last couple of years as a political sideshow. That's one of the nicer things, I think, that they've said about it. And, you know, Senator Jake Hoffman, who Mike referenced, and some of the other Republicans on this committee have expressed concerns about political viewpoints or policy viewpoints of some of the agency directors. I guess this all kind of gets down to the question of, like, what do you think the role of an agency director is, right? Are they the ones implementing policy? Are they doing what the person who won the election is asking them to do?
Well, it's certainly a new standard now, because the confirmation process was really to vet the qualifications of individuals, also to look at things that might keep them from doing those jobs in an impartial and effective manner. So, but now it's become very hyper-partisan. I agree with Mike. But the one, I think, criticism I would lay on the governor's office is that a lot of times when these nominations are put forward, they're usually backed by the governor's office getting coalitions and the industries to support their nominations. You've seen that with a couple of the nominees, but that was done pretty much on their own. Alec Thompson was also kind of a controversial. Jake Hoffman had indicated he's the state director of the lottery department. Mm-hmm. And Hoffman had said, well, we don't want him because of other things that had occurred. Well, he organized a very effective coalition of business leaders, tourism industry, folks that benefit from the lottery, and they came out in droves like an army. And that's the kind of thing that really didn't happen with the other agency directors. I think a lot of folks approached the governor's office, I mean, early on, saying, how can we be of help to get these nominations through? But there was really no follow through. And I think that was a big mistake, because a lot of times with these kinds of nominations, if you would have had a lot of these, like for Carmen Heredia, for instance, if you would have had a lot of
the access healthcare, director,
the healthcare organizations, the hospital CEOs, and even the, some of the business groups that I think would have been willing to support the governor, there really wasn't that effort to coalesce those interests to back her up.
So, Mike, the governor tried to sort of get around this committee by creating new positions and just appointing these people to those positions. The court said she couldn't do that, so they had to go back through this committee. At this point, is there anything the governor can do to try to make sure she has the agency director she wants? We're now 3 years into her term.
Well, I think that the one thing that you can do, as an example, Kara Crist, the former director of the Department of Health Services, resigned during the Ducey administration about 18 months before the end of Governor Ducey's term. They appointed an interim director and said they were going to do a national search. They never appointed anyone to that position. He remained the interim director until Governor Ducey's term ended. Mm-hmm. No one in the Senate brought up this issue. No one said, hey, you don't have a confirmed director. So what I would do if I were the governor's office is I would appoint interim directors for the rest of her term and not send anyone else to the Senate.
Do you think there's any chance that Jake Hoffman and the other Republicans in the legislature wouldn't try to call her out on that?
Oh, I'm sure they would. But there's no other option because, again, this, as Jaime said, this isn't just vetting you to make sure that you're qualified. This is there is a current director that has not been confirmed yet that was told he might not get confirmed because he has negative tweets about President Trump. That's a First Amendment right to criticize the president of the United States. And so if you're not going to confirm somebody because of that, it says a lot about that process.
Hmm. Jaime, let me ask you about, we heard a little clip of new ads from gubernatorial candidate Karen Taylor Robeson. She is going up with a multi-million dollar ad buy. We are still, 15 months away from the primary. We know that in her campaign, money is not going to be a problem for her. The fact that she's up this early, is it in any way surprising to you?
Well, first off, welcome to the 2026 election cycle.
Oh, we've been there for a while, I feel.
So, no, it does not surprise me. However, and I've said this before, I believe here and in other forums, that if Karen Taylor Robeson employs the same strategy she did the last time she ran for governor, which is commit a bunch of money, raise a bunch of money, and just go on the airwaves and not really do the ground game that I think is necessary, particularly in a primary, then the outcome is going to be the same.
She's ground game meaning like going out and shaking hands,
building
and meeting
coalitions,
people.
And really going to the grassroots activities that you need to do, especially in a Republican primary or even a Democrat primary. You really have to build those coalitions and entities that are willing to support you. But just going on the airwaves, Mark, it doesn't connect you with the grassroots and the heart of the party that I think is going to be needed to get her over the finish line. Andy Biggs is going to be a formidable candidate. He's seen as a very hardcore Republican, very tied to the MAGA interests. She's touting her endorsement from President Trump. Well, guess what? A week ago, President Trump endorsed Andy Biggs too. And I think most people, most Republicans, especially the activists, would think that that's the real endorsement. So that's where Robeson needs to identify herself a little bit better and be more aggressive in building those kinds of relationships that could be of benefit in a primary. And right now, I just haven't seen that yet.
Well, it's interesting. In her campaign ad, the whole thing was basically about how President Trump endorsed her toward the end of last year. Do you think that's sort of telling about what we're going to be hearing from her for the next year plus?
Well, I think there's been a couple of polls that have been released that show that already she's falling way behind
Andy Biggs, yeah.
Correct. And so I think what they want to do is try and inoculate themselves early on before it gets to the point where a lot of Republicans saying, well, she's not really a Republican. You know, she's not the kind of Republican we need. So they're going on the airwaves. They're going to spend a lot of money to say, not only am I a Republican, but I'm endorsed by President Trump, who's that's the be all end all for a lot of these candidates. So I anticipate that they're going to continue to do that because they're going to have to. But if they don't combine that with what I just said, then I think it's going to be just like what happened with Carrie Lake. She spent a lot of money, trounced her in fundraising. But at the end of the day, the heart and soul of the Republican Party just wasn't with her.
So, Mike, I love asking you to wade into internal Republican politics. I know it's an area in which you like to reside. I mean, would you agree with Jaime that we're just going to be hearing about the Trump endorsement from Karen Taylor Robeson? I mean, we'll hear it, of course, from Andy Biggs as well, but he's not on the air quite yet. Is this something we're going to be hearing from Karen Taylor Robeson from now till at least through next July?
Yeah, it's essentially her only play. Right. As Jaime said, the base of the Republican Party is already for Andy Biggs. She has to try to convince them that Donald Trump supports her more than he supports Andy Biggs. That's a tall task. It's going to take a lot of money, a lot of time, and a lot of effort. And again, as Jaime pointed out, you have to go out into that world. She's got to go to LD meetings. She's got to go shake hands with the precinct committee people who are all 100% MAGA focused. And if she doesn't do that, she can spend $100 million and she's not going to win.
Do you think it makes a difference when you get to the general election, whether or not it's Karen Taylor Robeson or Andy Biggs, if the primary has been mostly a fight over who President Trump endorsed more, does that in any way affect the general election, do you think?
I think it does because in the old days, you would, as a Democrat, might run a little bit to the left in the primary. As a Republican, you might run a little bit to the right. And then you try to come back to own the center.
You pivot to the center.
Right?
Yeah.
That doesn't happen now, and it's not going to. Karen Taylor Robeson cannot pivot back to saying, oh, I'm a McCain Republican now. It's not going to work. Andy Biggs will never do that. So now it's just two people on fighting over the MAGA coalition. How do you then pivot to the center? You can't.
Well, Jaime, it's interesting. We read a piece this week from Bob Robb, longtime, of course, political observer, wrote on his Substack about how in his mind, maybe Karen Taylor Robeson should have been running as an independent, which would have allowed her to sort of be who he thinks that she is. Do you think that if the primary election is basically who does President Trump love more, does that affect the general? Does that maybe give Katie Hobbs an opening?
Oh, it sure does. I think that, candidly, if Karen Taylor Robeson gets out of the primary, she'll be almost impossible to beat in the general election, because I think she'd be able to develop that kind of a coalition that of Democrats, independents especially, and Republicans to get her over the top. But having said that, and having said that Andy Biggs is going to be tough to beat in the primary, I think Governor Hobbs' best bet would be to face somebody that's much more of a MAGA, much more hard right, which Andy Biggs is, of course. But one of the things I've told folks is that Andy Biggs is not Carrie Lake. I think Andy Biggs is a very sharp candidate. I think he speaks very, very well. And he's not going to make the kinds of blunders that Carrie Lake did, and particularly offending the McCain wing of the party.
Yeah.
I don't think he's going to have those kinds of bombastic statements that she said about abortion or things like that. So while I think it'll be a much tighter race, I still think that Andy Biggs has a chance of being the next governor.
I'm going to disagree with Jaime here. Regardless of who wins that primary, the headwinds against the Republican candidate are going to be very, very strong based off of the way that the economy is performing, based off of the way the administration is
national
performing.
Headwinds.
National headwinds. And that's going to make it very difficult for either of them to defeat an incumbent governor who's going to have a ton of money herself.
Interesting. All right. That is Mike Hayner. I'm also joined by Jaime Molera. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, Mike Hayner of Lumen Strategies and Jaime Molera of Molera Alvarez. Jaime, let me start with you about a bill that the legislature passed and is sending to the governor. A lot of folks very interested in made in the USA these days. That apparently will potentially apply to all voting equipment and all the components in the voting equipment, the software in the voting equipment. Some of the county folks who are the ones who would have to actually implement this are saying, we're not sure that that's possible. Like, we don't know that the equipment exists that is being made in the U.S. Doesn't seem to be a concern, at least to House Speaker Steve Montenegro, one of the backers of this bill.
Well, I know you're going to be shocked, but there's politics that occurs in the Arizona legislature.
No. What? Come on. What?
That's crazy.
And so I think the thought would be they're going to send this bill to Governor Hobbs. Governor Hobbs would veto this bill, and then they're going to be able to use that in the election process to say, see, she doesn't want to secure Arizona's elections, especially from Chinese influence or whatever it might be. If I was the governor, I would sign this bill saying, yeah, you're right, let's make this happen. Because here's what's going to – if this were in law, in 2028, that was supposed to
– It takes effect in 2029.
2029. So in 2028, when they don't have that equipment and they can't make it happen – they're going to put in the budget reconciliation bill a footnote saying, notwithstanding this law, you don't have to do this for this next year. And they'll keep doing that because they can't comply with it. That happens all the time. So that's what I'm saying. If the governor, from a political standpoint, she should sign it.
Do you think the governor will call their bluff?
Possibly. But what I found interesting in the clip that you played about Speaker Montenegro talking about that was he said manufactured in Birmingham or Buffalo. Why not Phoenix? Why wouldn't you try and get something like that to be manufactured here in Phoenix so that we're benefiting, that Arizona jobs are created by doing something here in Arizona?
I would say either Bisbee, not Beijing,
or Benson or something. You need a city with
Is
a
it B.
You need a B city. So yeah. I mean, do you think this would actually do you think this could spur some American manufacturer to start building this stuff so that the components and the machines could be built here?
Sure. Absolutely. I don't have that knowledge of how the voting machine apparatuses work and the software that goes into them, but I would imagine so.
All right. Mike, we heard this week, and actually for the last couple of years, lawmakers and the governor have been trying to come to agreement on a renewal of Prop 123. This is, of course, the measure that was narrowly approved by voters a number of years back to raise teacher pay with some complicated stuff with the state land trust. This week, Republicans said that they're still in favor of doing this, but they also want to enshrine school choice in the state constitution, including ESA, school vouchers. This, of course, would not have to go to the governor because they would just refer it to the voters. The voters approved it initially. They'd have to approve it this time. Do you think that enough voters would support this if it included higher teacher pay but also vouchers? Like, does that do something to the electorate when it gets on the ballot?
Possibly. Again, part of the challenge here is that this, as you mentioned, passed very narrowly a decade ago.
With almost everybody elected in favor of it.
Exactly. Except for, I think, Treasurer DeWitt.
Yeah.
But again, I think that the challenge is now you're putting the vouchers in the Constitution. Does that give kind of the constitutionalist some pause? Again, I think the AEA and others will oppose it. So now you've got a robust campaign over all of these different competing measures within one thing. And is it even constitutional to put two separate measures like that? We're going to put some money for this from the state land trust into the public school system, and we're going to enshrine school choice in the Constitution. Those seem like two separate measures, and is it possible to do that in one ballot initiative?
It seems like, to go back to Jaime's point, politics at play in the legislature. Shocking, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this seems like it would put Democrats in a tough position, right? Because they want to increase teacher pay, but could they also vote for something that would enshrine this level of school choice, including vouchers, in the state constitution?
Well, again, I think that's going to be the choice, and whether or not they're able to get the votes to put it on the ballot, and then whether it withstands a court challenge, which will happen.
Well, the one thing I think we need to clarify, if this were not to happen, the money's still going to be there, right? That was part of the agreement Doug Ducey came up with, that we are going to increase the budget to make up for that shortfall that the state never did. The school organization sued, and the agreement was we were going to make them whole, but we were going to use the state trust lands in order to make that up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's already in the budget. This year, it's still going to be part of the it's all these other things that the legislature would want to do or interest groups that would want to do that the money's not there if this thing does not pass.
Well, it seems like it would be a—I mean, that's a pretty big chunk of the general fund if the legislature has to backfill that money with money, to your point, that they could be using for something else.
Correct. It's $300 million. In the grand scheme of things, honestly, it's not a lot of money. I mean, think about a $15 billion budget. So that's what's going to be interesting. If the school groups—I mean, it's more perception than reality, I think. I think a lot of folks will not want to vote it down because they feel like, well, we need to get more money into the schools, even though that money's already there. They're going to be making that argument, the proponents of this. It'll be interesting to see if the education groups, particularly the Arizona Education Association, the teachers union, will fight against it just because of the voucher issue. I would suspect that they would. But here's the other little twist on it. I think as the ESAs continue to remain in place, it's becoming more and more popular every single day. And the reason is that more people are utilizing it, more people know people that are utilizing it, and it's really all walks of life, Democrats, Republicans, Independents. You're seeing all families utilizing this. So is the fear of vouchers going to be as big 2 years from now? I'm not so sure.
Jaime, given, as Mike said, that the initial proposal barely passed. I think it was like 51-49 when it was approved. And
correct.
That had the Governor Ducey at the time on board. It had legislative Republicans and Democrats on board. Mm-hmm. If there is dissent among sort of the elected level or even interest group level, does that impact the ability of the renewal to pass, do you think, given that it was so close the first time?
Oh, sure it does. I think it'll be an interesting fight. But the first challenge is going to be there's going to be immediate lawsuits, to Mike's point, because of the single subject issue. But I've seen referrals done in such creative ways that the courts are, in my opinion, are loath to throw things out, especially when there's a lot of gray area. And certainly there's a lot of gray area in the law surrounding the single subject rules.
Mike, go ahead.
Well, and the other thing that you have to keep in mind is if they do that now, we have another year for someone to put a, if you will, a clean Prop 123 on the ballot as well. Go out and get signatures to say, hey, do you want to raise teacher pay? Right. If you do, sign this. And if you have two competing measures, then it gets a little dicier as to which one passes.
Is there talk of somebody trying to do that?
I think there was always talk of again, because the legislature has taken so long to deal with this. Remember, it was going to be in the first week of the session. Then it was going to be, you know, mid-session.
It was going to be last year.
Right. And now we're into the end of this session. I think people have been thinking about, should we just go to the ballot and do Prop 123 as a clean kind of renewal and move on from there?
Interesting. I think very quickly, Jaime.
There's a good possibility of that, but from a Republican standpoint, they kind of like that because it takes money away from other kinds of issues and candidates that those dollars could be going to help.
That is interesting. All right. Jaime Molera, Mike Hainer, thanks you both for coming in. Thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a sitcom star reflects on love, identity, and grief in his first double album. But first, more and more communities around Arizona and the country are looking at recycled wastewater as a solution for dwindling water supplies. That includes using it as drinking water. But for lots of residents, the reaction has been yuck. My next guest tried to figure out how to get beyond that initial response and convince people that it's really okay to drink recycled wastewater. While getting her doctorate at ASU, Marisa Mannheim did research on this and ultimately recruited skeptics to help create an exhibit on it. It was called The Future Taste of Water, and among other aspects, it included samples and a pleasant environment. And Mannheim says, importantly, it also included groups of people drinking the recycled wastewater together, which helps normalize it and allows people to move beyond their initial gut reactions. Mannheim is an assistant professor in the Department of Environment and Sustainability at the University at Buffalo. She joins me to talk more about this. And Marisa, what first got you interested in how people could come around to the idea of drinking recycled wastewater?
Previously, there has been a lot of outreach oriented around beer tastings. The idea being that you can recycle the water, and then people might be more hesitant to sample the recycled wastewater as just straight water. But once you turn it into a tasty beverage, that it's much more enticing, and it gives people a chance to potentially get over their initial hesitancy. And that has been a strategy that's been used around the world with a lot of success. So what we were interested in doing is taking what works about that form of engagement, but bringing it to a broader audience. You know, not everyone drinks beer, microbrews especially. Mm-hmm. And so we had an opportunity to work with local utilities and find out what works about beer tasting. So we did a study initially about the beer festivals and the beer tastings, find out what works with those, and then apply it to a more mainstream opportunity.
So is it something specific about beer that sort of brings people in? Like, I wonder if you serve them iced tea or maybe pasta that had been boiled in recycled water, like, would it have had the same effect?
I think it's just about finding what it is that is pleasurable and enticing to certain groups of people. So some people are really enthusiastic about beer. There's an entire culture around it, microbreweries. There's also an aspect of the brewers themselves being personalities, and especially trusted personalities. So there's a partnership that happens between the utility that's treating the wastewater and preparing it for brewing, and then the brewer, who then is kind of the chef that turns it into the tasty beverage. And that kind of amplifies or transfers the trust that a brewer has with their customers onto the utility. And, you know, one of the big challenges that utilities are facing nationwide is decreasing trust in tap water. So those kinds of partnerships can be really, really advantageous. But like I said, a beer isn't going to bring in every person. And so I think one of the strategies that utilities are starting to turn to is, what are the other enticing consumables that they can start to explore to bring in other audiences? So it can also be quite advantageous just to offer, you know, really nicely chilled, you know, treated wastewater on a hot day and in a summertime or an outdoor activity where people are really wanting the water, and it can be an opportunity to get them over those barriers.
How big are those barriers? I mean, we hear a lot about, you know, the sort of so-called ick factor, that when people hear, oh, this is recycled wastewater, you know, the phrase toilet to tap is one that I know a lot of municipalities and water utilities don't particularly love. Like, how big of a barrier is it to get people to accept drinking recycled wastewater?
Yeah, I mean, it's talked about a lot as one of the biggest obstacles. And I think one of the kind of key pivots of our approach was we saw people not as a barrier, but as an opportunity. And kind of stepping out of those ways of thinking opened up a whole new suite of opportunities to engage with different people to find out what would make the idea and the possibility of incorporating treated wastewater into the drinking water supply not only something that they wouldn't object to, but actually something they would embrace and even champion among their own communities.
Did you find that there's particular language that is most helpful in doing that?
Yeah, I think the language and terminology is both extremely important. And I think that sometimes it becomes, you know, oh, if we can only just find the right words, we'll be able to kind of work through all of these concerns. And so while I think it's really important to find these less technical terminologies, like moving away from the very technical terminology of direct potable reuse to something that's more about recycled wastewater, because then people know what you're talking about and it's not being hidden behind some technical terms. And also, you know, there's been really important work to find out about the types of terminologies that people really gravitate to. For example, pure water is something that people are really looking for in their water supply.
How much do you think utilities can and maybe should be playing into, look, this is something that's going to happen. You might not like it, but water supplies being what they are, this is something like you might not love it. We might not be able to give it to you in beer or popsicles or whatever else. You might just have to get used to the fact this is going to be coming out of your tap.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of truth to that. But I think the opportunity is to enroll people in that work of building resilience in the water supply, because as you know, people in Central Arizona are highly concerned about the security of their drinking water supply, and they want to do what they can to make the water supply more reliable in the future.
Do you get the sense that even with all of these interventions and things that water utilities can do, that there's some group of people who will just never get on board, that they just will not be able to get over the yuck factor?
I think that that's definitely true. There will always be a subset of people who will never be able to be convinced. And I think that that's probably a particularly true in the present moment. But that aside, the scientific research does show that people generally underestimate their ability to adapt to new circumstances. So when we're first proposed something that seems objectionable, for example, the concept that we will be someday drinking advanced treated wastewater as part of our drinking water supply, we say, hell no, I will never do that. I will never accept that. And lo and behold, 15 years from now, when it becomes a normalized part of the drinking water supply, there will be a time when it will be something that people don't even think twice about.
All right. That is Marisa Mannheim, an assistant professor in the Department of Environment and Sustainability at the University at Buffalo. Marisa, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Birth rates in the U.S. have been falling for years, and even though last year's numbers show a tiny uptick, researchers are hesitant to say it's a trend, mainly because the small rise was attributable to one group of women only, Hispanic women. Overall, we've been watching fewer people choosing to have kids, and that got our next guest this morning wondering why. Emile Niazi is a mother of three and a columnist for The Cut who writes about parenting. And she says it all began with a simple post on X that said, "Thinking about low birth rates, I'm curious, what's keeping you from having a kid or having more kids?"
I mean, I was just genuinely curious as someone who has kids, who really wanted kids with my partner. I just wondered what is driving people to have fewer kids. What could governments or workplaces or society in general do to sort of encourage people who might want or are, you know, even kid curious to go down that path? Because I care about this, and I care about making a world where my kids want to have kids.
Well, the responses came fast and furious, sometimes literally furious. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about it.
Everything from, like, you know, really sort of angry vitriol about, like, how dare I ask? Isn't it so obvious, like, the cost of living and housing and the world is on fire? I got some really thoughtful, clearly very emotional answers from people who I could tell were really struggling with this, you know, who either really wanted to have kids but felt they couldn't, or, you know, were on the fence about whether it was practical or feasible to have another one or have one. I was sort of taken aback by how much it was clear that people were really wrestling with this subject. Maybe it's something that would surprise older generations, how much we don't take for granted having children or having as many children as we want to have. Like, mm-hmm. This is very, very real for us. And it's very emotional. And it's something that I think more people need to contend with, because this is kind of this, the fate of humanity in many ways lies in how we approach familyhood.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So, okay, I want to talk a little bit more about some of the answers you got, some of the trends within this, right? Because they were very revealing, as you said. Lots of anger. I want to read you one that stood out to me. Someone said, I think any child of mine would likely experience more suffering than joy over the course of their life. So it would be unethical to bring them into the world. I wonder about that idea of the ethics of this. That came up a lot, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is something that came up a lot. That comes up a lot anytime people have this conversation online in particular. And I completely understand why someone would say that. Mm-hmm. It's something I sort of explored in an earlier column about, you know, having kids in an age of climate devastation. And of course, we're going to need to wrestle with the kind of world that our children are born into and inherit. That should always be part of the conversation. But this is such a murky idea when you bring ethics into something like this. My assumption as a mother has to be that I'm going to fight to make the world better for my kids. And I think that whether you have kids or not, that is how I think we need to approach the world going forward. Of all the scientists and climate researchers and really, really smart people, when I pose this question to them, they always say, as people who are steeped in the ethics of population and, you know, whether or not it's okay to bring more people into this world, for them, having kids gives them a reason to keep fighting. And they have all told me it's not about having one kid or two kids or three kids, that you are not making the difference tipping the scales on a 1 degree of warming. So you don't need to look at it like that. You know, I just don't think ethics, I think it's often used as a hammer to stop the conversation.
Yeah, which is so interesting. So I am pregnant now with my third child. I know you just had a third child who's not even a year old now. I wonder, this is a personal question, so feel free not to answer it. But I wonder, like, did you experience this? Like, I have felt throughout my pregnancy a level of judgment about this ethical question and about whether or not I should be doing this. Did you?
Yes. Well, first of all, congratulations. I was really surprised. It was a level of judgment that spanned many different areas. Other women who were sort of like, well, there goes your career. There were people who, yeah, were like, well, are you going to move into a bigger place, get a bigger car? You know, like people who are very judgmental about like the kind of space that I was bringing a third child into. Of course, people who were like, well, three children, you know, in this day and age, like with this economy and this state of the world, like how selfish. So, yeah, I was surprised because not but one generation ago, it was entirely normal. The ability to choose the size of your family these days does feel under threat. And I think on both sides, you know, whether it's not being able to choose not to have a child in some places because your ability to choose has been slowly eroded and taken away, or on the other side, feeling like you can't have more than one or more than two. It's a very loaded thing these days, the size of a family, your ability to choose whether or not you can have children. It's a really, really sticky conversation, but I think it's very important to have because it seems so fundamental, right?
Yeah, right. And I was interested in talking to you about this because you're coming at this from a different point of view. Like, you're not coming at it from a religious point of view or a particularly conservative point of view or, you know, like a trad wife kind of point of view. I wonder, like, coming at it from the liberal side of the spectrum, has that changed the conversation, you think?
I think more and more on that side of the spectrum, on the liberal side of the spectrum, I guess this conversation is changing. I think for a long time, what you've heard from someone like me was more on the like, can women have kids and also have a career? But also really pushing, if you don't want to have kids, that's also okay. And really clearing the path for that. And then when I sort of came of the age where I was starting to think about kids, what I heard a lot was honesty about how hard motherhood is, about how difficult juggling a career and motherhood is. So it started to feel very negative, the conversation about motherhood and about parenthood. And so I went into it really like bracing for something very overwhelming and terrible and dark. And then I got into it and I was like, oh my God, this is the best. Like making a family with someone that I love, that makes me laugh, that I have a great time with, who really is an equal player in this. Mm-hmm. That's very important. It's so fun. I think more liberals have let the other side dominate the conversation about familyhood, about parenthood, about motherhood. And I think that that is a huge mistake because so much of what is real, what is driving people when they get to voting at the polls is their family, is their kids, is the future. Why have you let the other side completely dictate the conversation about it?
Okay, so I want to end with, I think, the most poignant thing that you've written about this, from my perspective at least. You wrote this phrase, you said, hope is the currency of parenthood. What do you mean by that? Tell us the moments that led you to believe that.
And when someone says, if I were to have a child, there would be more suffering in their life than joy, that to me is the saddest thing that you could ever say. But I don't believe that. I don't believe that there will be more suffering in my children's life than joy. Do I believe that things are hard right now and probably going to get harder? Yes. But does that mean that I give up and lose my hope and lose my optimism? No. It means that I commit even harder to making things better because I believe in my kids' future.
Yeah. All right, we'll leave it there on an optimistic note. I appreciate that. Emil Niazi is a columnist on parenting for The Cut joining us. Emil, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Josh Radnor is best known as an actor. He played the main character Ted Mosby on the sitcom How I Met Your Mother, which ran for 9 seasons. But for the last several years, Radnor has also been working as a singer-songwriter. His first album was a collaboration with singer Ben Lee. And now he's out with his first full-length solo record, a double album called Eulogy. Radnor will be performing tomorrow night at the Musical Instrument Museum, and he spoke with my co-host, Sam Dingman.
You have a couple of songs about the way that you find yourself behaving when you're in New York City, and how the concrete like behaviors that you engage in New York City, you sort of recognize in yourself and sort of don't recognize as yourself, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
All the girls walk by and they are all so pretty. When I was in college, were these people even born? My God, and whoa. The feeling that comes over me when strolling down near Ludlow Street, I want to be another me.
I suppose I'm quite nostalgic is one of the things I battle in my life. Mm. This playwright I worked with, Richard Greenberg, I did a play of his off Broadway a couple years ago. And he has this line, I think he just said it very casually in an interview, but it always stayed with me. He said he thinks nostalgia is just a longing for a time you know you can survive. You know, that the present moment.
Oh, wow. That's beautiful.
Right? The present moment is so, can be so harrowing and so scary because we don't know. I only realized it while I was recording, but I ended up telling my friends, the producers, you know, I think this album is about death. I think this album is about the part of me that, you know, couldn't behave in New York City. I can certainly be in New York City and behave now in a different way.
Right.
That was a very particular moment in my life. But it was also like, there's a Buddhist statement that says, when you get to the other side of the river, drop the canoe, right? You don't need the vehicle that got you across once you're across the river. So a lot of these songs are about dropping the canoe.
Interesting. Interesting. But I have to ask, there's a way in which by making a song about them, it does seem like there's a bit of a desire to commemorate him or make some sort of musical monument to him.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a musical cemetery, but it's also like everyone gets a 21-gun salute or whatever. You know, like there's an honoring of the characters that were populating my life. I always think that you can write songs from two places. This is very broadly speaking. One, you can write songs as a protagonist in the middle of the confusion, like notes from the battlefield. Like, I don't know what's going on. I'm confused. I'm overwhelmed. And you can also write songs from the perspective of the wise elder, whether it's giving a kind of advice or wisdom to your younger self or to a younger person. But I play with these narrative focal points.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and if I may, you're talking about very vulnerable experiences on this record. Just to give one example, on the song You Can Sleep Alone Tonight.
I want to call her up, say, how are you?
How are you?
How's things? Are you doing all right? In a quiet voice, it tells me it's okay. You can sleep alone tonight.
That's a very tender space to explore in a song. And it makes me think of, there's a lyric on the record that I really love where you say, this is from a different song, but you say, you fear dirty laundry aired, I fear living and dying scared. And it made me wonder, like, was part of the goal with the writing on this record to be sort of fearless in talking about these tender experiences?
I don't know how much forethought there was around that. Mm-hmm. When I got, you know, I went to NYU to the graduate acting program, and we were trained to be publicly vulnerable and publicly truthful. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I, you know, rethought my whole personality and I was some, you know, clammed up kind of person who said, all right, on this album, I'm going to really be vulnerable and tell the truth. Sure. I've just found the artists I respond to are the vulnerable artists who kind of crack open their skull and pull open their rib cage and expose their heart. And, and it makes me feel less alone in the world because I suspect that most people's internal lives are quite tender and quite chaotic and quite confusing and scary. It's hard to be a human. Mm-hmm. And I've described everything I do as a campfire. My friend calls fire channel one. You know, that's the first channel we all kind of gathered around.
Ooh, and I like that.
And
that's
watched.
Great.
And I just love this idea that, like, okay, here's a fire. I'm going to be telling stories and singing songs around it. And if you find this fire and this circle nourishing for you, please stick around, you know? And if you don't, there's plenty of other campfires. But I think that when I write something that feels like that's honest and it's just edging up against the part of me that I don't want to share, I know I'm onto something.
This makes me think about a line that you wrote on Substack that I really loved. You said, quote, "The older I get, I'm finding it more and more important to be witnessed, to have my thoughts heard and my feelings acknowledged by someone other than a partner or blood relation." I wanted to ask, in that the same part of that Substack, you talk about having a weekly men's group that you talk to, and to whatever extent you're comfortable and wouldn't be betraying confidences, it strikes me that the kind of vulnerability that you're describing is something that is very much in the culture right now as a subject of debate in terms of what masculinity is or should be. Is this something that comes up in that group? Like, can you tell us how much those conversations inform your songwriting or the other way around?
That's a great question. You know, you can read a lot of my music and, you know, in some ways it's a reappraisal of manhood, right? Like, you know, the song you brought up, You Can Sleep Alone Tonight, there's a lot of cultural messaging around for men that getting the woman to your hotel room is what you're supposed to do.
Right.
But you get to a certain age and you've had the woman in your hotel room and you say, you know what? What if I learned how to be alone just in this moment? And what if I let her go on with her life in a way that I wasn't disrupting it because of my own neediness or my own sense of loneliness. And so it's almost like a revisionist love song. It's like, it's a new genre where it's not about like, baby, it's cold outside. It's more about, you know, it's more about, I think maybe we shouldn't, maybe it's better that we're alone and maybe I should learn how to be alone.
Right, right.
Yeah.
What if I could just sit with myself?
Yeah. And that's the part of me that started writing songs when I was 40 rather than 20. You know, I have a line in Joshua 45, 46, which closes Eulogy 1, where I say, I started writing songs when I was just north of 40. I try to write some every day. I wish that I had started sometime in the 90s, but I'm not sure I had much to say.
Huh.
And
yeah.
And I feel now I have some stuff to say.
Well, Josh Radnor is an actor, a writer, a filmmaker, and a musician. His new double album is Eulogy 1 and 2, and he will be performing on May 3rd. At the Musical Instrument Museum. Josh, thank you for this conversation.
Absolutely.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.
I can see the curtain is open.